We're live from WGLT as we continue our series of programs from Bloomington Normal today, an issue that both cities are grappling with that's a common theme throughout the country. Should local governments help federal authorities when it comes to deportation?
What do we want?
Immigration rights!
What do we want?
Immigration rights!
No more deportation!
What I think we have to have in place before we seriously would consider a welcoming city ordinance is the kind of what I call infrastructure in the community to make sure that we're not creating more problems for the people that we're trying to help.
That's Bloomington Alderwoman Karen Schmidt. We talk about both sides of this debate and how both cities are handling it. Plus, how has public outcry for gun control been affecting gun owners and gun lovers in Illinois? We speak with a Macon gun shop owner and director of a Bloomington shooting club. That's all coming up in today's special broadcast live from WGLT. We'll get started after this news update. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're continuing our series of shows from Bloomington Normal. This morning, we're broadcasting live from the studios of WGLT in Normal. And here, local activists have been pushing both the Bloomington City Council and the Normal Town Council to adopt what's called a welcoming city ordinance. They say it would ban local law enforcement from helping immigration and customs enforcement officials, and in doing so, would show immigrants that their city officials here will stand up for them. Like the rest of the country, this has been a contentious issue. There have been several versions of this proposed in both city councils. Some say the measure could harm relationships with federal authorities in other areas of law enforcement. Others say there doesn't need to be a measure like this. And of course, this is happening. Imagine how hard it is to get this passed in one city. This is happening in two cities, in two city governments between the towns of Bloomington and Normal. We're going to spend some time delving into this issue on the 21st. And as always, you're welcome to share your thoughts on this. Should Bloomington Normal pass such an ordinance? We'd especially love to hear from our listeners in this area. But as always, everyone listening throughout the state is welcome to chime in. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. It's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet us. Our handle is 21STShow. Joining me on the line to kick off this conversation is Rick Bleichner. He's chief of police for the town of Normal. Chief Bleichner, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
You're very welcome.
Chief, I wonder if we could start by just defining exactly what it is we're talking about. We've heard lots of these terms like sanctuary city and welcoming city. When you think about this idea of a welcoming city ordinance, how does this affect your job as chief of police?
Well, I think from my standpoint, I mean, as a staff member of the town of Normal, I mean, my job is to, I think, balance the community's interest and concerns and look at how we can get the best information possible and make the best recommendations we can to the council, who are the ones who ultimately will make those policy decisions. And so, you know, from my standpoint on this as position as the chief of police, I mean, my responsibility is to really try and do what I can to ensure that whatever ordinances, laws, or policies even that are put in place provide, you know, my staff, law enforcement, the necessary tools to investigate crimes when they happen and when they occur. And then I think the other part of it is, too, is that we at the town of Normal have a very good working relationship with our local, our state, and our federal partners. And we really have to do that and balance how those, you know, relationships benefit us. And I think we also have to do that in understanding of how sometimes those relationships, I guess we have to measure those and how that may benefit us. And then we also need to balance it and look at what potential concerns or issues may that create for the community at large or, you know, individuals or groups within the community. So overall, that's kind of it for me, is to making sure that, you know, the discussions that come up when I'm looking at them is that it doesn't unduly hamstring law enforcement in doing the job that they need to do. And that is really to, you know, protect the safety and security of officers and the public.
And Chief, that was a big part of what the Illinois Trust Act was. Do you feel like there's already sufficient Illinois law to cover this topic for you and law enforcement already?
I think that certainly, obviously, when the law comes out, I mean, in law enforcement, I mean, we're in the business of following the law and enforcing the law. And so that certainly is one of the things at a state level that I think is set, and we've had additional training on that since that came out. But I also think that local municipalities have the right to look at it and determine, you know, is that a good fit for them. Obviously, that's the baseline. Here's what we follow under Illinois law. Are there other things within their own community where maybe a local ordinance could would be appropriate? And again, I think that's kind of an individual community decision that has to be made. I will tell you that from my standpoint, I mean, our department has had a long history of community policing. And part of community policing really is sitting down together and having discussions about what the concerns are. And that's bringing, you know, supporters, that's bringing, you know, a host of people together, and some even activists or people that disagree with it, and listening to their concerns, because I think at the end of the day, there is a lot to be said for that process, for coming together, for having a discussion. And I think sometimes when that happens, we then can focus on, okay, here's some, where do we have some common ground? And if there are areas in which we have common ground, then, well, then let's focus on those. You know, let's not get caught up so much in the areas where we have complete disagreement and we'll never reach any resolution. Let's sit down and talk about the things that are, you know, we have in common and the interest. And at the end of the day, you know, there may be whatever issue you're working on, you may not be able to come to resolution, but in some cases you may be able to. So I think, again, there's a lot of value in coming together and having that discussion.
My guest is the Chief of Police for Normal, Chief Bleichner. Chief, do you have a specific position or a recommendation on whether or not Normal should pass a welcoming city ordinance? Is that something you would support?
Yeah. Well, I could not support, like I said, based on my comments, I would not be able to support something that, again, unduly, I guess, hampered law enforcement's ability to protect the public, to protect our officers, and to investigate crimes. And so if there was some ordinance, whatever it was that was proposed, that I felt did that, I would not be able to support it. But likewise, there may be a host of different, you know, solutions out there that would allow us to do that, would allow us to investigate crimes, to do our job, to protect the public, protect officer safety, that may not impact that. And so from my standpoint, it's all in the details. You know, we would have to certainly work through that and look at that. And again, at the end of the day, if there was something that I felt supported those interests, again, from a law enforcement perspective, then I would certainly consider that. So that's just, again, something that we would have to look through and look at the details on it.
And from a law enforcement perspective, where does it stand right now with your officers and federal authorities like ICE in terms of cooperating with enforcing immigration law? What does that relationship look like now for Normal police officers?
Yeah. I mean, certainly as part, I mean, like I mentioned before, we have very good working relationships with local, state, and federal officials and agencies. I'll tell you, really, our contact and our interactions with ICE is pretty limited, as I think most agencies in McLean County are, because the vast majority, from what I've been told, of immigration enforcement that's done is done as a result of through the jail or communications with the jail. And so I think part of it, too, is you know, obviously with a new administration, federal administration, president taking over just over a year ago, there's obviously a lot of, you know, concern about how immigration is going to be addressed based on some of the campaign things that he's ran on and some of the, you know, decisions that have been made since then. But again, in looking at that, in my opinion, I've not seen an increase in the amount of enforcement actions taken here, in at least in the town of Normal. So from my standpoint, it's been business as usual. We have not seen a negative impact or any increased presence, if you will, from ICE here in our community. But again, there have been a few times when we have contacted ICE specifically because it was related to an investigation that we were conducting, or we felt that it had information that could help us in an investigation. And, you know, again, but we do that taking into account or balancing what, you know, is that necessary, and is that going to benefit the overall investigation?
Chief, one last question for you. To the other side of that, we've heard conversations from not just undocumented immigrants, but also attorneys who represent them, about a growing climate of fear and being afraid to go to the police or talk to police, especially when it's situations that are unrelated. Of course, these are situations I'm talking about unrelated to their immigration status. I'm thinking about in terms of domestic violence or other incidents. Are you concerned? Are you hearing from officers about, are you worried about that climate and your ability to have community policing?
Well, I mean, I've heard that from individuals or groups that I've heard talk about that. What I will say is I've not seen that or heard that as a result from our officers. But then again, it's difficult to gauge. I mean, an unknown, something that did not happen, or, you know, what, all I can tell you is from our standpoint is that, you know, I think we have a pretty good reputation with the organizations that represent some of those groups. We have a pretty good reputation in the community. And I think our approach to how we handle law enforcement and how we balance that against the community needs, you know, resonates, again, with the community. So our hope is that, you know, individuals, if the crime's occurring, that people that they're interacting with or talking with would say, hey, you know what? Yeah, certainly we want you to report that. We encourage people to come down to the Normal Police Department and report that or call us because, you know, again, we have pretty limited in the grand scope scheme of things, you know, contact with immigration and ICE. And it's typically done really in, like I said, in direct relation to criminal investigations that are ongoing.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. We've got a caller, Nick from Chicago. Hey, Nick, welcome to the 21st. What's your question and comment? Nick, are you there? Nick, are you there? Okay, it looks like we've lost Nick. Nick, give us a call back if you have a chance. Phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Chief, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Sure, not a problem. And like I said before, I mean, in considering this, again, we really have to look at my focus is on officer safety and on the public safety, and being able to utilize the tools that we need to investigate crime. And so if there's a solution out there that allows us to do that and encompasses that, we certainly would be willing to look at that and talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm joined now by WGLT reporter Ryan Denham. Bob Bradley's also with us in studio here at WGLT. He's a professor emeritus of government and political scientist at ISU. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mel.
I should point out at this point to our entire audience right now, in the interest of full disclosure, that the general manager of this partner station, R.C. McBride, is also on the Normal Town Council. And it's important for our audience to know, as I gave you that disclaimer, that none of the general managers of any of our partner stations have any editorial input into the 21st. Ryan, also, I would assume, for the newsroom at WGLT.
Yes, we have a pretty thick firewall up between all of us here.
All right. Just important to make that, just in the interest of transparency, we want everyone to know that. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about this welcoming city ordinance that's being proposed in both cities. Ryan, can I just start by asking you, as we heard Chief Bleichner talking about this issue, what is actually being proposed? He was very careful to say that it's the details, obviously, they're going to make a difference to him in law enforcement, which obviously makes a lot of sense. There's an effort by both cities to pass similar language. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, in a nutshell, what's being proposed is an ordinance that would limit the type of communication that local police departments have with federal immigration officers, specifically related to potential deportations.
Mm-hmm. And for people who don't live here, I wonder if you can just give us a sense of what the immigration population looks like in the Bloomington-Normal area, and when did this issue first start being raised to both Bloomington and Normal city councils?
So if we're talking about the number of undocumented immigrants in Bloomington-Normal, that's going to be tough to say. Statewide, there's, I think, about half a million or so about 500,000. Hispanics or Latinos make up about 5% of the population here in McLean County. I mean, it's probably a pretty small number of undocumented immigrants who'd be most impacted by this. But regardless if it's a small number or not, for that person, it's a, you know, going to be the most important thing in the world. We also have two university campuses here, which sort of add another texture to it. ISU, where we are currently, has been fairly open about admitting and welcoming undocumented students. So when you're talking about how long this has been under consideration, more than a year. The coalition of proponents who've been supporting this ordinance have been pushing for more than a year, starting with the Bloomington City Council. It's been a bit of a source of frustration for them because there still hasn't been an up or down vote. And this contingent of supporters with the, they call it the Keep Families Together Coalition, they show up at Bloomington City Council chambers every month or so to try to put it back on the docket, but haven't had any success yet.
That's Ryan Denham with WGLT. And Bob Bradley, I wonder if you can also give us a sense of the demographics, as Ryan started to, of the population of McLean County. Certainly when we're looking at Chicago, we know that the undocumented immigrant population runs the gamut of different nationalities, whether we're talking about Irish or Eastern European or Asian or Hispanic, like most of the country, although I think the Hispanic population tends to get a lot of the attention. What does the demographic makeup of McLean County look like?
I think Ryan hit it on the head. There are some individuals here from West Africa that you don't typically talk about but they're here. And there are some from the Middle East that might be undocumented as well because of the university being here and the attraction to the science programs here. So it's a gamut, but much smaller than Chicago, certainly.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bob Bradley, former ISU professor emeritus of political science and government. WGLT reporter Ryan Denham is in studio with us here at our broadcasts from WGLT in Normal. As always, you're welcome to join the conversation. You can chime in with your questions or comments. You can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow, and we'll pick up this conversation on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
The 21st is supported by the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology, presenting Sandra Singh Low, host of the NPR.org podcast, The Lowdown on Science, for the Smith Group JJR Lecture, noon on Friday, April 20th, in the Beckman Institute Auditorium.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're live from WGLT in Normal today, and we're talking about an issue of welcoming city and an ordinance that's being proposed in both Normal's Town Council and Bloomington City Council. It's a discussion about what the role law enforcement should be playing in terms of cooperation with federal immigration attorneys. My guests are WGLT reporter Ryan Denham, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Government at ISU, Bob Bradley, are in studio with me here at WGLT. Ryan, we invited Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. He couldn't make it to today's program, but what's been the mayor's position?
So the mayor of Bloomington is very supportive of a welcoming city ordinance. He's shown up to rallies in favor of it. He's tried to muscle through a vote on it unsuccessfully, but where it come down to it and he had to vote in a tie-breaking situation, he would likely vote in favor.
And that's not necessarily the case, though, for the aldermen on Bloomington City Council. Where are they falling right now on this issue?
It's very evenly split. It looks right now that it'd be a 5-4 vote against the ordinance in its current form if it were to come to a vote. There's been a contingent of about 5 aldermen who've expressed different types of concerns about a welcoming city ordinance, and there's even some nuance within that group. Some say that it's casting an unfair light on the police departments. Some say it's too restrictive on police departments. Others say it's redundant, again, to the state law, the Trust Act. And so we have aldermen who are kind of stuck in this really interesting place. Alderman Karen Schmidt is an example of this. She's expressed concerns about it, but she's not exactly an anti-immigrant alderman. She's actually has a history of supporting people of color in our community. It's a really interesting situation a lot of these aldermen find themselves in.
You actually spoke to Alderman Schmidt. We have some audio of that. Let's hear what she had to say about this issue.
What I think we have to have in place before we seriously would consider a welcoming city ordinance is the kind of what I call infrastructure in the community to make sure that we're not creating more problems for the people that we're trying to help.
So, Ryan, it sounds like from that, she's saying she doesn't want this to create more problems for immigrants.
And she points to a state like California where she's seeing the problem perhaps exacerbated with anti-immigrant sentiment. She also sees the other side of it where she's making the argument that the most recent draft of this ordinance is too limiting on police. And she's got a lot of flack over this for her concerns about an ordinance. She's even going to face a potential challenger in 2019 in the election over this issue.
Bob Bradley is with us as well, a professor emeritus at ISU. Bob, that's a nuance that I think you don't necessarily often hear in the immigration debate. Oftentimes we think of it as being pro or anti-immigrant. How do you think the debate that's playing out here, how often are you seeing this nuance reflected in other cities? How does it compare?
I think it actually is appearing in many other cities, which is why a lot of cities have not jumped on the bandwagon as of yet of being welcoming cities because of this nuance. Because, for instance, Alderman Smith, I think, has been very unfairly categorized as anti-immigrant. That's totally against her character in all manner of way. But simply because she is issued some opposition to this specific proposal, people have argued that she's anti-immigrant, and in fact she now does have an announced opponent in her race to be reelected to the city council. And the opponent's running strictly on the fact that Karen Smith was opposed to this proposal.
And is there a version of this where everyone's happy, Ryan? How do you think you see this playing out?
No, I don't know if that's possible. I think ultimately the mayor of Bloomington will try to get this to a vote at some point. Ultimately, it just may not pass. The last time that a contingent of progressive activists took something to the city council, it was a police civilian advisory board, kind of in the wake of some of the shootings we've seen across the country. That was successful. They did get that to a vote, and it passed. But I don't know if this one will get there.
Bob?
I don't think it'll pass in its current rendition. And the reason for that is twofold. First of all, it puts the onus of being a welcoming committee completely on government. And welcoming committees across the country have realized it's got to be a partnership between churches, nonprofits, universities, the business community, and government. And then this also is solely focused on the working relationship between local and federal law enforcement. Welcoming, to be welcoming, is much, much bigger than that. And this community would go very far in realizing that.
That's Bob Bradley, a professor emeritus of politics and government at ISU. I want to thank him for joining me, along with WGLT's Ryan Denham, who's been covering this issue really closely. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
And to that point about the idea of a welcoming city ordinance being expansive, that same idea is behind another program that just launched mainly in Chicago, but it's actually meant to be reached people statewide. There's more than 20 health providers and hospital systems that have created a partnership that they say will help make sure immigrants and refugees have access to health care, especially those who were affected by the Trump administration's policies. That partnership is being led by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and their health care policy director, Luvia Quinones, is on the line with us. Hi, Luvia. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for the invitation.
Luvia, as we've been talking about, immigration is a complicated issue. Healthcare is as well. So I wanted to start by simply asking you about this partnership, which you're calling the Illinois Alliance for Welcoming Healthcare. What problem is this alliance trying to solve?
Sure. So we're trying to address two issues, both around fear and anxiety. What we have seen in the past year and a half is significant number of individuals, not only here in Illinois, but also here and across the country, of foregoing health care, having a fear that either cops or immigration are going to be at their local clinic, local hospital, and not wanting to get a lot of the preventative care that many of us know that we need. The other issue that we're addressing is also the fear of having high hospital bills for being uninsured and waiting until the last minute or waiting until the health situation is big enough or important enough to go to their emergency room. So through this alliance, right now we have 20 providers, as you mentioned, including many hospital systems. We're still trying to recruit more providers. And the idea is to create model policies for any health provider, whether it be a hospital, a free clinic, a federal qualified health center, to really look internally and see what can they do to create more of a welcoming environment for everyone.
And so from that perspective, what practical steps are you asking health providers to try to take to address all of these issues you've just laid out, Luvia?
So as part of the alliance, we've developed, you could say, a set of principles as well as some commitments where we lay out the importance of all health institutions that are going to be a member of the alliance to make sure that they are servicing anyone, regardless of race, gender, and a few other things. You could say kind of to how some of our members say it's kind of, you could say, the human rights principles. We're also asking them to do one of several options, whether it be internally identify a staff person that's going to be the point person in case immigration or the cops do go to the health institution, or try to conduct a training to make sure that it's culturally sensitive. We're giving them a couple of different options, but most importantly, we want to make sure that anyone that's involved with the alliance is committing to serving anyone, regardless of immigration status, language, etc.
And is this something that you're looking at with healthcare providers in the Chicagoland area, or are they across the state?
No, it's a statewide alliance. So we do have providers outside of Chicago and Cook. So right now, for example, we have Amita Health, which serves a couple of different suburbs in the state of Illinois. We also have the Lake County Public Health Department involved. We're in the process of trying to get some providers from Champaign as well as from downstate. And we also have some providers all the way as far as southern Cook County as well.
And if people are interested in joining you, it sounds like you're doing a lot of outreach then throughout the state and not just in the Chicago area.
Correct. Yes. If anyone is involved, they're more than welcome to contact me. My information is on the website, but you could also either email me, which my email is my last name, so it's LQUINONES@ICIRR.org. And we also have, just to make sure everyone knows, we also just launched as part of the alliance a resource hotline for anyone that's looking for health resources, is either uninsured or has some issues with the health provider. And this hotline is available statewide in 4 different languages, which are English, Spanish, Arabic, and Polish.
I want to thank Luvia Quinones for joining me, a health policy director with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, on this new alliance that has just been announced in this past week between healthcare groups led by ICIRR. Luvia, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Since the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School back in February, public calls for gun control have reached a fever pitch. Guns are increasingly a topic of conversation, especially as we're seeing teenagers around the country marching and speaking out against, in favor of gun control. But there's also been demonstrations on the other side. Just this past weekend, about 100 Second Amendment advocates from various groups gathered at the state capitol in Springfield with unloaded rifles as a pushback to these protests. Across Illinois, we know that hundreds of thousands of people apply for FOID cards each year, according to data from the Illinois State Police. In fact, one out of every 4 people in Illinois legally owns a gun. That's according to a 2015 study by researchers at Columbia University. So how does this renewed anti-gun rhetoric affect the thousands of people that are in the gun business? How about those who are FOID card holders or just gun lovers? And what is it like to be pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun at a time when anti-gun sentiment is so high in some parts of our country and the state? Joining me now to discuss all of these issues is Joe Miller. He's the director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting in Bloomington. He's with me here at WGLT in Normal. Joe, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Also joining me on the line from Macon is Dan Cooley. Dan owns the Bullet Trap, which is just south of Decatur. Hey, Dan, thanks for being with me as well.
You're most welcome. Nice to be with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Joe, can I start with you? As I just said, you're the director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting here in the Bloomington area. Can you tell us a little bit more about the range and the people that you work with on a daily basis?
Oh, our club is a junior club. It started out as a junior club. We've got several seniors in it. Basically, it's a club that's aimed at competitive shooting. We're kind of anxious right now because one of the young ladies that has trained with us is out at the OTC, the Olympic Training Center, shooting for a spot on the National Junior Olympic team.
Wow.
So we really focus on competition. And with that, a program of training, start with kids. We start with 10-year-olds and go all the way through high school and college kids. Really, our first basic focus is safety. Safe gun handling, the responsibility that goes with that safe handling, working with other kids of their age and older, respect, so many life skills that we focus on in this whole process of setting a goal, a work ethic to get to that goal, and it's not easy to do. And with that work ethic, the responsibility, the desire, and when you accomplish that goal, it's really a trip as a coach to see a sparkle in a 10-year-old eyes that they're now shooting 8s instead of 7s, and to see them accomplish those goals and move forward in skill.
And what ages do you work with?
We've got about 8 people, women and men, that coach. My side is more the experienced kids, the advanced shooters. We've got 2 or 3 people that just love to work with 10-year-olds, and they can get those kids to perform. You wouldn't believe what some of them do.
So you start at age 10 and go up to college, it sounds like.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you're talking about this as a different perspective we've seen from young people in the country. We've heard in the past couple of months since the Parkland shooting, we've seen so many young people who say that they want to have better gun control laws. They're very worried about the amount of guns in this country. What kind of response are you hearing from the young people you work with when it comes to these sorts of discussions?
Oh, our program is growing all the time, and it's simply because we have to look at the big picture in that, I'm an old guy now, but when we grew up, it was owning a gun was part of everybody, the rural environment. Now there's so much urban population, and kids don't know anything about it. I've been to several situations where people have said, oh, I'm not interested in that. I don't want to. Well, have you ever tried it? Oh, no. I don't like guns. I'm not around them. And, it's almost, to me, feels like it's a 3-year-old in Beats. If you've never tried them, how do you know you don't like them? We invite a lot of people. We have several mothers of kids who came out, and they started seeing what the fun the kids were having and what they were accomplishing. And the mom started shooting. We're almost going to have a women's team next year, air rifle shooters. The other side of it is what kids learn. I've had the opportunity to work with 2 autistic kids. And one of them, Joe, was minimal verbal skills. And he started shooting with us. And it's simple, it's a lot of movement and touch and get him into the right position. And he ended up winning the Illinois State 4-H Air Rifle National Championship.
And I know the numbers of this is McLean County has the highest participation among 4-H for shooting in the state. That's part of the reasons why we wanted to have this conversation here. We're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. Dan, I want to get to you and find out a little bit more about the bullet trap, your perspective on all of this. Joe Miller's here in studio with me in Normal. He's been telling us about Central Illinois Precision Shooting Club. Tom Lisi's also going to join us as well coming up after the break. You're always welcome to join our conversation. If you have questions or comments, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21STShow. Just after the break, we'll pick up this conversation about guns here on the 21st, live from WGLT in Normal. for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're live at our partner station, WGLT in Normal. We're talking about the fact that one out of every four people in Illinois legally owns a gun. I'm talking about that with Joe Miller. He's director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting in Bloomington. We've been talking about the 4-H participation in this club, highest in shooting in McLean County in terms of participants. Some of their folks, as he's been saying, they've got one young woman who's competing to be in the Junior Olympics as we speak. On the line with us from Macon is Dan Cooley. He owns a Bullet Trap, which is just south of Decatur. Dan, I wanted to just ask you, when it comes to buying a gun in Illinois, obviously you can't just walk in and take one off the shelf. And Correct. This differs compared to other states in terms of the laws that are in place. Can you explain the process for what it's like to buy a gun from a shop like yours for someone who's not familiar?
Certainly. And I would like to say I really applaud Joe for his efforts with training the youth of this country, too. I think that's a fantastic effort and a very important part of the overall gun dilemma we're in right now. As far as Illinois goes, we're one of the most restrictive in the nation. Most states do not have a FOID card. Everyone thinks that's a federal thing. It's not. It's strictly the state of Illinois. So you do have to procure a FOID card first. And when you do that, you have to go through a background check through the state Illinois State Police and go through the process and answer a bunch of questions and fill out the application and get approval. Then once you have a FOID card, you can come in and purchase firearms or ammunition. When you come into our shop to buy a firearm, we'll engage you in some conversation as to what what you want it for, what the purpose is, how you intend to use it, just to get a kind of a general background from folks to make sure that they appear to be on the up and up. And then we require two forms of identification. We require the FOID card, Illinois driver's license, and we put that information on the 4473, which is a form everyone has to fill out prior to purchasing a gun. And there's extensive questions on there for each one to answer, and everyone has to answer those truthfully. And then after that's done, we phone the approval process in Illinois State Police. In that procedure, we go online and enter to your name as it appears on your FOID card, your date of birth, and your FOID card number. And the state police go into their computer data bank, and they also go through the federal data bank at that point to make sure there's no problems in your background that preclude you from legally owning a firearm. And after that's complete, we get an approval from them. And then during this whole time, there's also a waiting period that applies. If you're buying a long gun, it has to be 24 hours before we can give delivery after the initial agreement to purchase. And if it's a handgun, it needs to be 72 hours before we can give delivery and purchase after purchase. And the next step is come back to the store and then complete the transaction. And we require identification once again to make sure it's the same person who filled out the form. And that's basically what the procedure is to buy a gun in Illinois.
As you're saying that, Dan, Joe is pulling out his FOID card here for me to look at, and it does look like a driver's license. So Joe just pulled it out of his wallet and showed it to me. Dan, what are folks saying? And I wonder, as is often the case, are you seeing more people coming in? Have you seen more people come into your shop in the past couple of months since the Parkland shooting trying to buy weapons?
Yes, we have. And, I don't like to profit from a tragedy such as that one, but there is a definite interest. And I think they had the largest NICS background check in history. It's last March, which is approval for people to buy firearms. Doesn't mean they did, but they went through the background check. Largest ever, set a record. And we're seeing a big increase in FOID card applications. We do those here as well. And a lot of our people that let them expire or lost them and now want to get them back, and new people as well, but that's a marked improvement over what we've been seeing in the past. There's a big influx of new people getting interested in owning firearms. I think they're concerned
about you? Why did people? So, what are reasons do folks give you for why they're coming in and applying or renewing?
Most everyone I talk to says they want to get a firearm while they still can before they're outlawed. They're concerned about all the proposals in Springfield and on national level as well. And I think a lot of them are buying firearms because while they still can. There's a great deal of concern about that in this country.
Dan, are you worried about the future of your business? Before I even ask that, I wonder if I should ask you about how you feel about bans that have been proposed on military style or, as Joe's been telling me, all black weapons, as they're often called, or bump stocks.
Yeah, that's such an arbitrary thing. These assault weapons, the labels they've put to them, they've tried to define them in a dozen different ways. there's lots of other guns out there that operate exactly the same, have the same rate of fire, same potential for mass killings, if you will, that being the excuse they use. They went after one particular rifle, and it just amazes me that they do this, because it's not going to accomplish anything. I guess the thing that concerns me most.
And Joe, do you agree?
Oh, totally. Dan would be a great one to testify. There's a difference in Illinois and everybody else. Illinois has a shotgun culture. A lot of it's based around deer hunting. We don't use rifles. So people in Illinois say, well, there's absolutely no reason to use them. But you go outside of Illinois, in Missouri, in Iowa, Wisconsin, that style rifle, because they can hunt deer and are more deer rifle culture, they're all over. It's a light gun. It's easy to carry, and despite what you see on the Outdoor Channel deer, you carry it a lot more than you shoot it. It's easy. It's easy to clean. It's easy to operate.
Shotguns are.
That AR frame is.
It's much the lighter. AR frame is. Okay.
It's much lighter than the shotgun. So there's just a different attitude. I guess the other thing with FOID cards that get me is, and Dan knows this well, as soon as I became a FOID card owner, or if you have a concealed carry license in the state of Illinois, the state police run a background check on me every day. It's a scan, but every FOID card in the state of Illinois is run every day. And if you're a concealed carry license carry holder, the enhanced background check is run on you every day, 360 days a year. And I guess my problem with that is the NIC check, the National Instant Criminal Background Check, is a big topic all over.
And you feel like that's already happening here in Illinois, it sounds like.
It's happening in Illinois. The issue is that when the federal government passed the background check, the NRA, as a national organization, was behind that, and it's a great idea. The issue is there are only 4 states in the nation that send all of the data that should be required in the background check. That's Hawaii, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Illinois. And those are only 4. And you start wondering, everybody's hot about background. The law is in place. Why aren't the other 46 states uploading that information?
Dan, is that something that you would like to see as well?
Yeah, that's been applied universally. I mean, everything, just like Parkland, that fell through the cracks in about 4 different places.
Yep.
And, the federal government once again show they count very efficient at administering any type of program. And law enforcement dropped the ball in several places there. That should never happen had they followed through on the procedures that are there. We don't need more laws. We need better enforcement of the ones we have. And that brings me one other quick point I'd like to make before this ends. I'm very frustrated about what they're trying to do with firearms right now, because all the people who have firearms and FOID cards are law-abiding citizens that never have and never will cause any harm to anyone. But what we haven't done, excuse me, my voice is going, what we haven't done is address the school issue. That can be solved, too, just like hijacking was solved by hardening the airports. We need to harden the schools and prevent this from happening. And I don't know if one legislature's done one thing yet to do that at this point in time. It's more about getting the guns.
And what would you like to see, Dan, in terms of schools, when you say hardening schools? And certainly there were a lot of instances in Parkland where that did not happen, including the fact that there was a police officer who was on the scene who didn't go into the school. What would you like to see when you say hardening schools? What do you mean, Dan?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is metal detectors. That's highly doable. We do it at the airports. We can do it at the schools. Second thing that comes to mind is better camera systems. There's no reason at this day and age and the technology we have that any school can't have complete coverage with the camera, so law enforcement can see where the problem's at. Once they're alerted, they don't have to wait for somebody on their cell phone to tell them where the perpetrator's at. They can see it right there on the camera, know how to approach the situation. There's lots of good locks made for classroom doors now. Some is just as simple as a cable and a snap that'll keep them out of the classroom. And lastly, I think we should arm those teachers that are willing to be armed. And when I say that, I don't mean carrying a gun on their hip. That's not my point. I think it's in Ohio they put a biometric safe in each classroom right inside the door, and any teacher that has access to that, they use his fingerprints to gain access to that firearm if needed. And it's only for those that have been trained or willing to take the training and willing to step up. It should not be required. But that's the last line of defense. And all four of those things are very, very doable. And we did it for the airports. We've done it, you know, for the traveling public. But no one's done anything for the kids yet. And no wonder they're concerned, whether they're sitting ducks, and they know it. And no one's doing anything about that.
Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm really uncertain about arming teachers. But that's just as strong as that is to have a resource officer. And you talk to the police departments and law enforcement, to have an RSO, resource service officer, involved makes all the sense in the world.
And what about in cases like Parkland, where there was a resource officer
who didn't do his job? And he should have. I have no comment on that. Mm. But what bothers me is when in the state of Illinois, there's a law proposed to have resource officers in every school, and our legislature turns it down, especially when it's turned down by Chicago people, where it's such a hub of illegal firearms.
To that point, we've got one more person I wanted to add into this conversation just as we get to the end of it. Tom Lisi, who's a reporter for the Herald Review, who's on the line from Decatur. Hey, Tom, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, to Joe's point about laws in the state legislature, what are we seeing happening in discussions in the State House in Springfield about possible changes to gun laws?
Yeah, a lot of them are pretty familiar to the national discussion after Parkland. The bump stock ban, which you know obviously refers to the Las Vegas shooter, limiting magazine capacity, how many rounds can be in a clip, and the issue of semi-automatic rifles and raising semi-automatic rifle purchases to a higher age restriction of 21, which is what handguns currently are. You have to be 21 to purchase a handgun. And then, of course, Governor Rauner vetoed before his primary election the licensing gun stores bill that had passed both houses, and he did veto that. And the Democrats in the Senate and House are trying to bring it back and override the governor's veto, but they probably will fall short on that.
We just have a minute or two left, so I want to end by Joe and Dan letting you all have the last word on this. And Joe, I think regardless of how someone feels about guns, I think it's probably fair to say that this is a pretty contentious topic in America right now, and this can become very tense. And I just wanted to ask you, for someone who might have a differing opinion than you, what you would say to them.
I was very upset with the demonstrations after Stony Brook. When they went through, the demonstrators were carrying little signs that said, you know, the NRA is baby killers. The laws that we have proposed, except for bump stocks, I see no purpose in those. But as a competitive shooter, I wouldn't. But I'm a law-abiding gun owner. The state of Illinois says do this, I do this. The state of Illinois says do that, I do that. Why are all the laws focused basically on the law-abiding people? What about the drive-by shooters? We catch them. Well, if I had a firearm. And what ends up happening? Well, he does so much time, but the use of a firearm in a crime, most often, if you look at if you read the paper and listen to the news, that breaking of one of Illinois' gun laws is thrown out for something else.
Dan, can you answer that question? Sorry to put pressure on you in 30 seconds. We're almost out of time.
Okay. Well, you know, it is difficult to convince people that firearms are, you know, should be accepted and be acceptable to everyone. I guess my biggest complaint is, you know, if you don't want to own one, by all means, don't. No one would expect you to. But when you go after the firearms and the ability of law-abiding folks, just like Joe was talking about, to defend themselves and their family, then that's a pretty big step there.
We'll have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining me. Dan Cooley is owner of the Bullet Trap in Macon. I want to thank Joe Miller, director of Central Illinois Precision Shooting, Tom Lisi with the Decatur Herald and Review. And that does it for us today for the 21st. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.